The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
And it's our speaker's preference to be addressed just by his surname. So in this these legal environs, it's my great pleasure to welcome Judge.
Thank you, Peter, very much. Now, please turn in this sheet which you have on the table to page 2 of it, where you'll see the first paragraph on page 2 begins with Plato of Athens, the arch enemy of my philosophy teacher, Karl Popper. And in the next paragraph, you'll see the word Stoic. My wife used to say, that's what's wrong with me. I'm a Stoic. And at the end of that paragraph, this is the one beginning the Stoic school, you'll see the word Chrysippus. Chrysippus is a philosopher of the 3rd century BC, that is, after the conquests of Alexandria. And notice he comes from Cilicia. That's where Paul of Tarsus also came from, the province of Cilicia. That's just a coincidence. But pick a few things out of this slab from Chrysippus. In the first line, there are certain fixed periods of time. This is a doctrine of fixity, a key, an absolute principle of truth. Truth arises from fixity, not from change. And notice in the second line of the citation, I'm midway down page 2, the cosmos was first constituted. Now, Chrysippus doesn't think what you think. He doesn't believe in creation, for example. So what does he mean by saying it was first constituted? And if you run your eye a little bit, you'll see that it's a fairly dramatic scene, this universe. And it also has a kind of ending and a beginning. You can see the word beginning in the second line of the long quotation halfway down page 2. The word for beginning is archi, a legal term, meaning power, office, government, things like that. It also means beginning or principle, the point from which things flow, a very comprehensive word. It's exactly the same word as the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible begins with, in the beginning, the archi, God created. And notice in the third line then, there is a conflagration and destruction of everything. The Gospel of John also begins with the words, in the beginning. In that case, the logos, or word, another key Greek term. So we are dealing with writers all writing in Greek, using the same vocabulary, and appearing at a first glance to say the same thing, but there are radical and fundamental differences that affect us all directly today. If you keep your eye slowly moving down that large slab in the middle of page 2, you'll see that the word again, the stars again move in their orbits, each performing its revolution in the former period, and then key words, without any variation. This is the principle, the fundamental principle of all Greek philosophy, that everything was fixed. It can't change. All that's happening is it is rotating. Stoicism is tied to a rotating universe. And the so-called beginning is simply the principle of the thing. The cycle can be deemed to begin at a certain point, and it comes back to that point in a vast conflagration, then starts again. Go back to about 3/5 of the way through the slab, everything will go back to what it had before, experiencing the same activities. Every city and village and field will be restored just as it was. There's another Greek word which comes through on the biblical side in the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 3. The restoration of everything is anticipated, but it's a fundamentally different restoration. This restoration is done again and again and again forever, is the doctrine. So nothing is destroyed and nothing is created. Everything is fixed, and all the apparent movement that you see around you on all sides is simply circular. Look at the way the passage ends. There will never be any new thing other than that which has been before, but everything is repeated down to the minutest detail. Are you finding life a bother? Don't worry, you'll have to do it all again next time round, and you will do it willy-nilly exactly the same next time. And after you've done it all again, you will come back on the next grand rotation and do it yet again, forever. There is a powerful doctrine of eternity here. Everything is fixed forever. Everything you do, you are doing because it was so fixed. And you'll do it again and again forever. This is a glorious hope for the world, taken deeply seriously in the time of St. Paul. Indeed, people complained that he had failed to correspond with the great Stoic philosopher of his day, Seneca, who thought many of the same things, it seemed, using the same words. So in the 4th century, they made up the correspondence between Paul and Seneca to make sure that Paul got it right. He didn't, in most people's view. Anyway, that's the cheerful Stoic view of your life. Just look down about 6 lines up from page 2 at the bottom. You'll see in the English paragraph a fateful name, Anaximander of Miletus. Anaximander's doctrine was not that the world was changeless, but it was limitless. So there was no end. We knew that already from the Stoics. But in every other respect, it was unlimited, absolutely. Here are two master doctrines of Greek philosophy, long before Plato. We're talking about the 6th and 5th centuries BC. The philosophy of changelessness, as we see in the Stoic doctrine later, and the philosophy of limitlessness. Turn now to the next page, on page 3, the first new paragraph on page 3. There was a rival school to the Stoics, the Epicurean school, arising in the same century as Chrysippus, and they held the doctrine of Anaximander, handed down centuries before, that there was no limit, changeless indeed, but unlimited was their doctrine. And it produced in the Epicurean school a different mentality on life. It's not as though you should sit there like a Stoic knowing that you had done this all before, numerous times in your previous incarnations, and you just had to moderate yourself to what must be the fixity of things, the Epicureans took a step further, thanks to Anaximeter, and there was absolutely no framework in which all this could happen because everything was limitless. And so their conclusion was how to live your life in a limitless universe. Everything was, of course, random. It has to be random, otherwise there would be limits around it. And the conclusion is, since it's random, then nothing matters. Anything could happen. And this is the fundamental Epicurean doctrine. It is wildly opposite to the Stoic doctrine, where you know in advance everything that you're going to do and will do again forever. The Epicurean said, you know nothing. Anything can happen, and you don't have to worry. And so the Epicureans, not the Stoics, were seen by critics of the gospel in antiquity to be dangerously atheistical. Only the Epicureans and the Christians were denounced as atheists. The Stoics were very conscious of divinity, as you can see if you go back and read through the passage I've given you. Now, I don't know who's managing me, and I don't know whether I've finished yet, but I've got something more important to tell you. Turn the page where you'll see our topic today is an open universe. And I don't suppose I need to tell you that we live in a universe such as the world has never seen or even imagined before our own time. Only in my lifetime, in the lifetime of most of you, has it been possible even to imagine this. And yet, within a single lifetime, all the certainty about the structure of the universe has been swept away. Even Einstein, who laid a century ago the vital doctrine of relativity for the nature of everything. Everything was relative to other things, and hence the modern, undoubtedly correct, I don't doubt it, nobody doubts it in my view, the structure of the universe itself is built out of a continuous series of relativities. Einstein himself, who made the fundamental observations long ago, could not accept the conclusion. And even as an old man, when he was settled in America, in Princeton, before his death, he wanted still to detect what he called the cosmological constant. There must be, in this relativized universe, something that is fixed. Einstein was a classicist. That's how he was brought up, the fixity of truth. And of course he was left arguing with his own marvelous disciples who carried it far further than his relativities did to give us the scene we now have, that there must be this constant, there must be something continuous. In the end, before his death, he gave up. There is no cosmological constant. Nothing within the universe is forever. I've tabulated in this table on page 4 what I think are the fundamental differences between Athens and Jerusalem. You don't have to say Athens and Jerusalem for these columns. You could say Caesar and Christ, for example, for them. Or you could say Aristotle and Augustine, or Seneca and Paul, or whatever you like. It doesn't matter about the headings. I use Athens and Jerusalem for our bipolar mind. We don't think I'm saying you belong on one side or the other. You belong on both. All of these things that I've written down here are true of all of us. These are our words. It's the English language. We all use all these words all the time. And they are not contradictions of each other. This is not the black and the white, but the two columns nevertheless trace the bipolarity of our culture, in my view. It is a random list. It begins at a fixed point, cosmos and creation, a Greek cosmos or a Hebrew creation as a starting point, and it ends with the two fundamental intellectual methods that are the only methods. And they are both created in the Greek language. The one is philosophy, and the other I've modestly called science, but I really mean history. Science is a form of history. Look at the middle of the table. What is history? History is the alternative intellectual discipline for reason. What is reason? It is logos, same word that opens the Gospel of John, as it happens. But in the Greek philosophers, logos means something like rationality, the fixity of things. And the modern discipline which inherits this has its Greek name, philosophy, and it's on the other side, the principle of inquiry. What say your reason fails to tell you a convincing explanation of what happened? Then you have an inquiry, historia, finding out what actually happened. Now, finding out what actually happened delivers you knowledge. You can do this finding out if there's a problem. There's got to be a problem. A judgment is needed. And so you appoint an arbitrator. The Greek word for that is histor. That's the person who judges things, and he has to do it by collecting the evidence. It's a dispute over privileges, for example. This is from Homer. We're talking about Homer long before the philosophers. History comes first, not philosophy. When philosophy got going, don't think I'm mocking philosophy. Philosophy is a great cultural achievement of Greek culture. Nobody can explain why the ancient Greeks developed across several centuries this extraordinary phenomenon of explaining everything as rational. There can't be anything else except what is rationally delivered. It's still true. That's what modern philosophers are always doing. What do they deliver us? What do philosophers give us? They give us truth. What is truth? Pilate didn't know. No one knows what truth is. But we all know it when we see it. When we're accused of a contradiction of terms, we are confronted with plain, elemental, philosophical truth. You can't say two opposite things and believe them both. And so many parts of our culture are dependent upon truth. Mathematics is a form of fixed truth, as far as I can see. I don't do it, so I don't know. But going back to the more important side, I could have said history at the bottom, but I've decided to say science, because science is the Latin word for knowledge. Not truth, but knowledge. Nothing has ever happened, notice the word, we're not talking about fixity. Nothing has ever happened in this world, or presumably ever will, that can give us knowledge. Knowledge is not truth. Truth is what is necessarily the case. That's why philosophers are so isolated in their lives. They live in necessity of truth. It's very important. I'm not mocking that. It's a key thing. But knowledge is also absolutely fundamental in our lives. And we can't, in fact, know anything unless it has been found out by somebody doing the checking. as to what actually happened to lead to this result. It is very difficult to think of anything in human life that does not rest upon knowledge that has been found out. When you're born, you have, of course, your biological instinct to cry, presumably, to be fed. What else do you inherit? It's not even clear that you're taught how to walk until somebody else shows you how to do it. But almost certainly, everything in our life, except the ultimate biological origins, is a construct of things being found out. You have to find out how to ride a bicycle, for example. You can't do it by instinct. And so our whole life is embraced by this massive heritage of what is known. And what is known is what somebody has found out. And that's what we call science, and the method is history. What is history? It's inquiring where there's a problem to find out what happened. I have thought of something else to say. Can I say it?
Absolutely.
I want you to look on this bipolar table called Athens and Jerusalem on page 4. And looking down the columns, just let me say first, apart from the top and the bottom, there's no sanctity about what gets into these columns. I just threw the words down. You can replace these words with all sorts of other words. And they're not opposites of each other. They're our bipolar aspects, if you like. Now, the one I want you to look at is 5 up from the bottom of the list, the Athenian concern with proof, based, of course, on your quest for fixed truth. You have to have a proof, and the proof was formal logic. I was actually taught formal logic, and when we did arithmetic, for example, or geometry at school, we used to have to formally prove things by writing down the steps towards a theorem. I don't suppose they're still doing it. And at the end of it, you had to write QED. I don't think they do that now, which stood for Quod Erat Demonstrandum, which means this is the point which had to be proved. And you have, as a student in your classroom, you had proved the theorem by taking the steps which led to the fixed proof, known in advance, of course, but you established the truth of your theorem by proof. And Galen, the great medical philosopher of the 2nd century AD, whose huge corpus of medicine was practiced in our culture right down through the 18th century and stopped only in the mid-19th century when they discovered microbes. That's what put an end to the great heritage of proven medicine. It was all wrong because they didn't know about microbes. For example, when you had a fever, what was wrong with you in the ancient world was you were too hot. That's what's causing your fever. So you have to reduce the heat by bloodletting. They didn't know about microbes. But the proof was fundamental. And Galen said of what he calls the school of Moses and Christ is that they can't prove anything. And all they talk about is empiricism. What is empiricism? It's finding out by experiment what actually happened. That's empiricism. And Galen said, you can't accept that. He knows what the school of Moses and Christ. This is the 2nd century after Paul. He knows what the school of Moses and Christ is saying. And Paul gives the answer to his complaint, which he hadn't seen, of having no proof. He said, our proof, he uses their same word, our demonstration, is spirit. He doesn't say the spirit. Is spirit and power. So Paul in advance staked his claim on experiment, the empirical discovery of what actually happens in your life, for example, or anywhere. Galen, the great man in medicine. Truly, I'm not mocking him. No one mocks him. He's a fundamental figure in our culture. He rejected the empirical method. Who is Paul? Paul endorsed. He is a prophet, in my view. Paul, the prophet, who prophesied that the truth will come by finding out experimentally. That is the origin of our modern world. He didn't make it, but he solved, he provided the counter-truth, if you like, the counter-assumption.
Now, we have some questions here. First question, when Caesar crossed the Rubicon and said, the die is cast, what column was Caesar drawing from?
Oh, Caesar is, in my view, a 100% Epicurean. Caesar didn't care two hoots. Caesar, in my view, don't quote me, no one else says this, Caesar is a convinced Epicurean. That is, he assumes an entirely random universe where anything can happen and nothing matters. So you live a happy life, taking what comes and taking your chances, above all chance. It's accidental what happens, according to... But this is what the crossing of the Rubicon is all about. It's a gamble by Caesar. Caesar is the great gambler. I'm the only person I know who doesn't admire Caesar, and I don't. Read what I've written about it for the reason. And it's not certain that he was an Epicurean, but he is behaving clearly in an Epicurean manner. He says it himself, I've done enough, I don't care what happens at the end. That's why they assassinated him, because he didn't care.
So he's a gambler, so he says the die is cast.
The die is cast is a gambler's term. A die is a thing you throw on the table when you're gambling. And it's a shrug of your shoulders, okay, here we go. That was his approach to life. He knew he was going to be assassinated. Oh, you also, he said to Brutus, when they got their daggers out for him. He knew, because he knew it was all pointless. He'd had his gamble, and he says, I've lived long enough for glory, that was all I wanted. Don't treat Caesar as a great founder of everything. He is a destroyer.
Thank you. Can you explain the beauty and wonder distinction in the table? So there's a number of questions about the table you've provided on page 4. Can you explain the beauty and wonder distinction?
This is a private grouch of mine, like all the rest, I suppose. But I'm against beauty.
You're against beauty?
Yes. I of course, suffer from it and love... I love beautiful things, obviously. Who doesn't? And beauty is obviously biologically fundamental in life. How do we fall in love except by beauty? But the reason why I dared to put it in the wrong column, if there's wrong and right, is because, now listen to this carefully, you biblical people, there is no test of beauty in Scripture. In particular, not in the Pauline letters. Nothing is admired. There is no aesthetic dimension in Pauline thinking. And Jesus rebuked his disciples on one famous occasion when they admired the beautiful stones of the temple. What did Jesus say? I'll knock it all down in 3 days. It is a flat rejection of the criterion of beauty. And the criterion of beauty grips our culture 100%. That's why we have to listen daily to the supposedly intelligent thoughts of people called actors. What on earth does being a pretender, how does that qualify you to know the truth about the world? Absolutely not. But because of our aesthetic engulfment with physical human beauty as well as things, we are tied to the tyranny of aesthetics in our culture.
So does that mean that you would reject the beauty of holiness movement in the medieval church?
Yes. The holiness which is beautiful in that phrase is the holiness of God. God is beautiful. except you don't see him. And this is the glorious conviction of the children of Israel, fundamental to our culture, that the source of everything, the source of the universe, the creator, no less, cannot be seen. There is no physical dimension tolerable. No, Islam has inherited this too. Any depiction of any living creature is idolatrous. You must not turn to the beautiful thing to symbolize God. And yet the fascinating thing, read the Psalms daily. The sense of reality about God is overwhelming in the Psalms. The psalmists argue with God and say, put me to the test, and this kind of thing. And God puts them to the test and so on. There's a huge battle going on over a person you cannot see. And in Jewish philosophy, even to try to imagine what God looks like is idolatrous. And yet the reality of the presence of God in the mentality, at least, of the Hebrew people, right down to our culture, is overwhelming. Nothing like this occurred in Greek philosophy. The idea that everything can hang upon a figure whom you vividly know because he speaks to you in some sense. And you are bonded and you argue with him. The psalmists are always complaining and arguing with the Lord, whom they dare not see and wouldn't dream, and denouncing the idolatry of everybody else. So the beauty of holiness, the phrase is a trap. It doesn't mean God loves beautiful things. That is an anti-biblical modern corruption, in my view.
It's God who is holy. I'm going to ask, why is judgment in the Jerusalem column? That's our next question.
Where is it in the column? I can't see it. Yes, in the middle of the column, judgment. Well, you can see what I've said against it. Theory is the feat of the human mind, the analytical feat of the human mind, to conceive of the truth. But judgment involves the individual. There is a problem. You have to decide. The histor had to settle a dispute over rights in the case of Homer, but also over information. The histor has to actually find out what happened. He has to get testimonies and so on. And then he has to reach a judgment, which it was a dispute after all. So which is right and which is wrong? It's a human matter. It is not part of the fixed universe, this question of right and wrong. It's a question of who did right in the particulars, whose claim was right. And judgment, arbitration, deciding, qualitatively, if you like, we'll come to this better on a subsequent occasion. We're still at the cosmic level. But judgment belongs to Jerusalem. And the great hope, where is the world going to end? It will end in a judgment, where righteousness will apply and everything will be put right. Not forever, necessarily. Don't start me on that. Anyway, enough.
Well, there's another question about the cosmic level here, referring to a modern author. The question reads, Jordan Peterson, in his book The 12 Rules of Life and An Antidote to Chaos, refers to the Tao and talks of chaos, feminine, and order, masculine, and the correct place to live is on the border of order and chaos. Is this another way of incorporating fixed and limitlessness?
If by Tao you mean the Chinese concept of Tao, is that right?
I'm not sure, but I think so, yes.
I've said somewhere in this paper that my lists are not yin and yang. This paper was delivered, I may say, in Shanghai, to the Academy of Social Sciences in Shanghai, in both Chinese and English. So if you can't understand the English, the Chinese translation is available.
Thank you.
And I may say the whole thing will appear in print in the United States in a book which they're already advertising if you want to buy it. But going back then to yin and yang, The trouble with yin and yang and so on is the equipoise between the two, and I think. And essentially, yin and yang is a doctrine of fixity. That's my guess.
Okay, thank you. Is there such a thing as Christian Stoicism? Are they compatible or are they mutually exclusive? That's our next question.
Yes. Stoicism has been profoundly important for everyone, of course, but also in the Christian tradition. And that's why, as I mentioned, they thought Seneca should have had it out with Paul. And so they wrote the correspondence, which you can read. But they never met, of course. And but I'll tell you this about Seneca, the great Stoic philosopher. He deeply admired the Jews. In a culture which hated Jews, typical situation, don't think it was invented in the modern world, but the phenomenon of Judaism unnerved Roman culture. People, one of the poets, Horace, no less, says, you ought to join our gang like the Jews do, getting people to join their lot, join our lot, the poetic group, you see. And anyway, Seneca says a striking thing about Judaism. He says rather plaintively, let me first insist, the Romans were in cultural reaction against Judaism in, you might say, the classic way, and at the same time, they were transfixed by the interest of it. People were, as Horace complained, people were drawn into Judaism because it was compellingly interesting. Guess why? Seneca says why. The Jews know why they do things. That's why. Notice carefully. The Jews have knowledge, not truth, knowledge. They know why they do things. And how do they know it? They know it from history. It goes back to the Exodus, etc., and to Moses, and to Abraham. The Jews know all this. And Seneca himself, a great scholar, knew, as all Romans knew, as they could not explain their own origins. They had plenty of myths to tell them about the wolf who suckled the Romulus and Remus and all this. They knew all those things, and they knew they were just stories. So the Romans couldn't explain themselves. It was a very great academic. In the generation before Paul and Seneca, Varro wrote comprehensively on everything and found Roman cultic practice insoluble, meaningless, he said. But what the Jews had was a meaningful account of why they do it, and the reason is because it happened. And that's why they do go on and on and on and on, upsetting people, because they've got a form of knowledge that others do not have.
We've got time for one more question, because our time is almost out. And you may wish to answer this next week, Professor. The question is the modern state on the side of Athens and the modern-day church on the side of Jerusalem, or are they all mixed up?
Well, of course they're all mixed up, but the church is often on the side of Athens, like being very happy with Stoic people and bishops like that, and so on. Say the other half of the question.
Is the modern state on the side of Athens and the modern-day church on the side of Jerusalem, or are they all mixed up?
No.
So it's asking about the modern state.
The modern state is 100% on the side of Jerusalem, because it's looking for change. We're all now taught to have... We must prepare for change and get ready. This is a contradiction of the fixed universe of Athens, flatly contradicting it. We are in total contradiction of the Athenian view of the world. Total, in my view. And 100%. Our culture is 100% biblical. E.g., in the great 19th century, the great masters of the 19th century who made our age are all heretics of Jerusalem. Darwin, the evolutionary doctrine, is a biblical doctrine in the sense that it sees the biological order as developmental. Things proceed and change. It is a changing scene that Darwin gave. He knew it was congruent with the scriptural thing. The reason why evolution and the Bible didn't seem to get together well was a historic thing that came later. Marx, a clear heretic of Israel. Marx was brought up. He learned classics. He knew everything. But his doctrine is a doctrine of change. You can rectify what's wrong. Freud, the psychoanalyst, the inward developmental problems that everyone has, all of this huge waves of new thought of the 19th century flow wholly from the Jerusalem side. Don't let people tell you this is a de-Christianized world. It is not. It is a fundamentally biblically shaped culture that we have. Ask somebody who doubts it, so you believe in a fixed universe, do you?
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Professor. Please join with me in thanking Professor Edwin Rush.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.